Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're joined now by Douglas Johnson, Legislative Director for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We're going to spend some time talking about the media coverage of partial birth abortion. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
Doug, what has been the case with regard to media coverage on this particular life issue up to this point?
Well, you know, the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act was first introduced in Congress in June of 1995. And for about a year and a half, the public was told by the media again and again that this was an extremely rare procedure, done only hundreds of times a year in the whole country, and only done in extreme dire medical circumstances where the mother's life was in jeopardy or the baby had some profound disorders or malformation incompatible with life. Now, we said from the beginning that there was abundant evidence that that was untrue, and that the partial birth abortion method was, in the vast majority of cases, used for no medical reason. But that was presented as fact, not as one side's claim, but as fact, by most of the major media for a year and a half. And then an interesting thing happened. I think you remember this. In early 1997, that whole misinformation campaign really collapsed. Two things happened. Several major newspapers belatedly actually went out and interviewed a bunch of abortionists and found out, to their amazement, that these were done thousands of times a year, mostly involving no medical circumstance, healthy babies, healthy mothers. And immediately after that, the spokesman for the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, which is a trade association, if you will, of hundreds of abortion clinics and abortionists, admitted that this was just this whole claim that this was so rare and done only in these dire circumstances was a party line that they cooked up. That was his term, party line. He said it was false, and he said the truth was, in the vast majority of cases, these are done in healthy fetuses, is what he said, healthy fetuses of healthy mothers. He said it again and again to every publication that interviewed him, and it got enormous publicity. Now, nothing is, so that finally the truth was agreed to after all the misinformation. So, and yet now, 6 years later, as this bill has come into the spotlight again, we have seen a recurrence in some major newspapers and news media of these myths being once again perpetrated or propagated as fact.
So what have your efforts been? I read a headline recently from the Boston Globe that they were going to change their policy on abortion stories, in particular stories dealing with partial birth abortion. You're cited in the story. What have your efforts been in this regard?
Well, when we see this mythology that we're a newspaper just asserts in its own authority or in its own voice, as we say, that this is a rare procedure done mostly or only in these dire medical circumstances involving the mother or the baby, we challenge it, and we cite seven or eight or nine authorities as much as we can fit into an email or a letter to the contrary. And these authorities are abortionists who are performing partial birth abortions, spokespeople for the abortion industry who admitted this was wrong, major journalists who've gone out and interviewed a bunch of abortion doctors. We're not just making these unsupported claims. That's where you have a division. Some of the press, editors, reporters, when given this information, say, oops, and they run a correction, and they say, we won't do it again. And that's what the Boston Globe has done now. Now, they've run a lot of really propagandistic stories over the years on this subject, and so we welcome this new directive that says they will not make those assertions again because they are not factual, that they will use the term partial birth abortion from now on because that is the term that Congress has adopted, that is the name of the bill, and a few other points. That doesn't mean that, you know, the millennium has arrived. I expect that we're going to see things in the Boston Globe that we think are wrong in the future on other abortion-related issues. But it is a substantive response, and we commend that. There's another group of press that just totally is non-responsive. They either simply say, we stand by our story, it's accurate, and they will not, of course, respond on any substantive point because they can't. There's nothing they can say back to these authorities. There's no evidence they can bring forth to defend the myth because there isn't any. So they simply refuse to address it. And we have had that experience in the recent past with Gannett News Service, with the San Francisco Chronicle, with The Guardian, which is a major British newspaper, and some others. And I think that goes beyond then just a question of accuracy or competence and gets into a question of journalistic ethics.
The ombudsman for the Boston Globe, Christine Chinland, had recommended guidelines now for that paper to use the term partial birth abortion. She says it's an accurate term, and it's also attached to the legislation that's been making the news here. Before this shift in policy, what euphemisms were the Globe using for this procedure and as that were also popular in the rest of the press?
Well, you often see it said that partial birth abortion is not a medical term and that the real medical term is, and then the words that follow may differ in different papers. Some say the real medical term is dilation and extraction. Others say the real medical term is intact dilatation and evacuation. Some say the real medical term is intact dilation and evacuation, and so forth. Now, these are just all jargon terms that were cooked up by individual abortion doctors, or groups of them, in at least one case, long after the bill was first written. So they are not legal terms of art, such as legislatures have adopted. More than half the state legislatures have adopted the term partial birth abortion, and so has the Congress. So that is the legal term, and the definition adopted by the Congress under this bill is what would be banned. So we say the press should just say what the lawmakers say. They ban partial birth abortion, and here's how they've defined it. It's an abortion in which the fetus or baby is delivered outside the body of the mother past the navel. More than half the baby is outside the mother before that baby is killed. Now, that's right in the bill. It's crystal clear. If a reporter takes one sentence to put that in the story, then the reader knows exactly what it is that Congress is banning. But instead, we see these efforts to, I would say, obscure what the argument is really about. That the term partial birth abortion is perfectly accurate. It is indeed a partial live birth, or partial birth for short. And the reason that the pro-abortion groups don't like the term is that it's all too descriptive of the way these types of abortions are actually performed. And I think that some reporters and editors and TV producers shy away from it for the same reason, not because it's inaccurate, but because it's all too descriptive.
To what degree do pro-choice forces depend upon euphemisms in order to continue to make their case for things like partial birth abortion?
Well, I think I don't want to tar everybody with the same brush, but I think it's fair to say that abortion on demand in America has always depended upon a web of lies and euphemisms from the very beginning, and that continues right up until this day. And often the media adopts, many organs of the media, let's say, adopt a kind of phraseology and also characterizations that soften the rough edges of abortion sort of prevent a lot of the really grim, ugly realities from coming into sharp focus. And that really, I would say, the debate over partial birth abortion, which began in 1995, was the first time a lot of Americans heard anything very specific about how any type of abortion is performed. The abortion industry, the pro-abortion advocacy groups, didn't like that one bit, and their immediate response was to cook up this party line, which they knew was false. Of course they did. And they put it out knowing that there would be a lot of people in the institutional news media who would want to believe it, who did believe it, and who presented it to the American people not as one side's claim on a disputed issue, but as unvarnished fact. So I would hope that that a lot of the news media would have learned from that experience, and some of them have. I mean, this was the subject of a certain amount of self-criticism. There was even a PBS documentary on how the press had been suckered into accepting these baseless claims by the abortion movement. And yet, as I say, there's some who not only don't remember that, but who, when presented with it, reminded of it, refuse to look at the evidence even now.
Finally, Doug, I'd like your reaction to Marjorie Siner, who's a spokesperson for the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. She said that the guidelines at the Boston Globe that would use the term partial birth abortion, she called them surprising and unfortunate. She said, it's tragic that anybody would give any credence to this nonsense about women walking in with the great big bellies and saying they've changed their mind. No way. It doesn't happen. She criticized you and National Right to Life by saying, his group has hammered away at this, and their purpose is not to clarify, but to confuse. Your reaction?
Well, she can say it three times, but that doesn't make it true. Look at what two abortionists told the Bergen Record in 1997 when they went and actually asked and were told in one clinic they did 1,500 partial birth abortions a year. The abortionist said, and I quote, "Most are Medicaid patients, black and white. Most are for elective, not medical reasons. People who didn't realize or didn't care how far along they were. Most are teenagers." End of quote. The same conclusion was reached by the medical writer for the Washington Post after he went out and actually interviewed a number of abortionists. And he said, the typical patients tend to be young, low-income women, often poorly educated or naive, whose reasons for waiting so long to end their pregnancies are rarely medical, end of quote. And I could read you quote after quote after quote of that type. So this lady from the pro-abortion group simply doesn't know what she's talking about. In fact, the vast majority of these abortions done in the fifth and sixth month do not involve any medical circumstance.
Douglas Johnson, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Douglas Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We were talking about the media coverage of partial birth abortion. If you would like to check out the website for National Right to Life, here is their address, nrlc.org, nrlc.org, or you can call National Right to Life at area code 202-626-8800. That's area code 202-626-8800. Their website address again is nrlc.org. Earlier today, I also had opportunity to interview Steve Feldman. Steve Feldman is managing editor for Biblical Archaeology Review, published in Washington, D.C. Yesterday, and you may have seen this in the news, there was an announcement by the Israeli Antiquities Authority that the James ossuary, this bone box supposedly with the inscription of James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, is a fake. This is a debate. I began our conversation by asking Steve Feldman to give us a brief history lesson on the James ossuary.
It came to light last fall in October. We held a press conference to announce that we were about to publish an article that we thought contained very important and exciting news. It was by a professor at the Sorbonne in Paris named André Lemaire, a very respected expert in ancient scripts. He had been shown what's called an ossuary, which is a stone bone box of the type that was in use in the first century A.D., particularly in Jerusalem. And this unfortunately was not found in an archaeological excavation, but it belonged to a private antiquities collector who saw that there was an inscription on it but didn't know whether the inscription was significant or not. And Professor André Lemaire studied it and realized that it indeed might be very significant because he read it as James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And the article explained how the script matched the script of the first century A.D. and explained the burial practices, Jewish burial practices of that time, and explained that, even though there could be several people who could have been named James, who had a father named Joseph and have had a brother named Jesus, it was very unusual to make mention of the brother on such a bone box. And he felt that it was very likely to have been the bone box of James, you know, mentioned very prominently in the New Testament. We ran that article first because of the stature of Professor Lemaire, but before we ran the article, we wanted to satisfy ourselves that this was not a modern forgery. I mean, there was no question that the box itself was the stone box was ancient, but whether the inscription had been carved in modern times. So we sent it to what's called the Geological Survey of Israel. That's a government agency there who studied the inscription, and they found that there was nothing, as far as they could tell, that made it seem a forgery or anything modern about it. They found that there's what's called a patina, which is a very thin layer, microscopic layer that accrues on ancient objects over time, that patina was on the box and also within the letters themselves, though not completely present in the letters because it was clear that somebody had kind of scrubbed the lettering to try to clean it up and make the letters more visible. But they did find patina in the letters, and so they felt that the letters themselves had been scratched a long time ago. Then, shortly thereafter, the box was sent to Toronto, to the Royal Ontario Museum, one of the great museums of North America, where it was on exhibit at the time to coincide with the big meeting of Bible and archaeology scholars that was taking place that year in Toronto. So about 100,000 people saw it in the space of about 6 weeks. Unfortunately, as many people heard, when the box was shipped to Canada, it cracked on the way, and the people at the museum there basically fixed it, put it back together again. And while they were doing that, they took the opportunity to study the object themselves, and they conducted several examinations, and they too came to the conclusion that the inscription was ancient. Now, that report did not get much play because it's just only appearing now in our forthcoming issue of our magazine. So it's been studied by leading script experts. It was looked at by the Geological Survey of Israel, and it was examined by the Royal Ontario Museum, all of whom felt it was authentic. The because of all the publicity and the questions about where the owner might have gotten this object, the Israel Antiquities Authority seized the box when it was returned to Israel after the exhibit in Toronto, and they appointed a committee of scholars to study it. And their report, well, it wasn't released yesterday. We still haven't seen the full report, but their conclusion was released, and they felt that the inscription was a modern forgery. Now, my understanding is that a lot of their conclusions were based on the work of, in particular, one geologist who was on the committee, who felt that he could distinguish between the patina, that microscopic layer that was on the box in general, and the patina that was within the letters. He felt there was a different patina, that somebody had tried to basically fake patina to make the inscription look old, that it was kind of ground up chalk and water, hot water, boiling water that had been placed in there to try to make it look old. So that's why the stories went out yesterday saying that, you know, Israel experts say the inscription is a fake. And, you know, they might be right. I would just caution people that two other teams of experts examined the same object, and they thought it was authentically old. So I really don't know what to say. I would say that we, you know, there's still a lot to be learned from all this. Nobody outside the committee itself has seen the committee's report, full report, as far as I know. So I'd like to see some outside geologists, for one, take a look at the work of all three teams that have looked at this object and give us their evaluation, which one they think seems to have been the most thorough and most up-to-date, most relevant examination, and see if they're persuaded by any one of them or by if they're persuaded by any of them at all. I think the jury, personally, I think the jury is still out, even though the news reports went out saying that it was deemed a fake. I think there's still a lot of a gray area here that needs to be cleared up.
So is it safe to say that this ossuary is an artifact? Its antiquity, its authenticity is probably more in dispute today than it was last week, but no conclusive facts are as yet in evidence to say one way or the other, is it authentic or is it not?
I personally think that we don't know yet enough to come down hard on one side or the other. By the way, there's no question that the box itself is ancient. The only claim is that somebody in modern times, obviously to increase its value, no doubt, may have wanted to put some very important, you know, biblical names on there to make people think that this was a more valuable object than it would be if it didn't have those names. But there's no question that the box itself is an authentic, you know, probably first century box. The question is, does the writing on it go back to the first century, or was it done in recent years? And on that question, I believe we're still not sure.
In another twist to this story, the owner of the James ossuary apparently earlier this year attempted to sell a second seemingly priceless artifact known as the Joash tablet. That also made the headlines as well. And the Antiquities Authority there in Israel has also ruled that to be a fake as well. Is there any evidence on this Joash tablet that would say whether or not the Israeli Antiquities Authority is correct on that judgment?
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody question that judgment. And Speaking for myself, it wouldn't surprise me that that would be a fake. As soon as that came out, all kinds of questions were raised about it from the very beginning, and we covered that in our magazine as well. There was just strange phrasing that people who are specialists in ancient Hebrew recognized as really being based on modern Hebrew rather than ancient biblical Hebrew. There's also some question about a few of the letter forms. It seemed like there was kind of a mishmash of letter forms from different times and places in the ancient Near East. So that seemed suspicious from the very start. So that, frankly, does not surprise me. Of course, there is some element of guilt by association, so to speak. They both come from the same collector. Though, by the way, the collector claims not to own the Joash tablet. He seems to present himself more as a middleman for the true owner. But still, they came to light. Both objects came to light from one person in Israel. And so, if one of them is very dubious indeed, you wonder, well, can you trust the reliability of the other one? And that's a real question. But I've read some of the statements and phrases put out by the Royal Ontario Museum, for example, and they seem pretty convinced that the James inscription, based on their good hard look at it, would be very hard to fake. So either there's a very clever forger out there who's fooled the Geological Survey of Israel and the Royal Ontario Museum, or maybe it's we need to study this further. And by the way, if there is a forger at work, this person would have to have terrific knowledge of the ancient script, which is a very arcane subject. The top specialists have said things like, if this is a forgery, it's a fantastically well done forgery, comments along that line. Plus, he'd have to know how to at least fool the Geological Survey of Israel and the Royal Ontario Museum on hard science geology type of matters. So to think that there's one person who's that good out there is a little bit, to me, hard to believe, but it might be true, and it would be quite stunning news. It's almost like movie type of drama at work here.
That would be almost as big a story as the ossuary being authentic. Someone who could make it look as authentic
right.
as it looks to the expert.
Right, and if it's fake, we hope the guy is caught and put in jail. But like I say, I'm just not sure who to believe at this point. It sounds like dueling experts to me.
One last question, Steve, mm-hmm. before I let you go. Given the fact that we do have experts we aren't talking about guys who do this as a hobby. We're talking about people who have devoted their entire careers to understanding the script, to understanding the geology of these ancient artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Given the fact that these people of good faith are disagreeing over the James ossuary, is it reasonable to expect that this its authenticity or lack of authenticity will ever be a settled fact?
It may never get to a point where most people can say pretty confidently one way or the other. It may not. Somebody suggested it might be sort of like the Shroud of Turin, where you're going to have arguments back and forth, and you'll never really settle it to everybody's satisfaction. I hope that somebody can evaluate the testing that's already been done, or who knows, maybe in the future some other team of specialists can look at it, so we have a very definitive ruling that most everybody can agree to, but it may not happen.
Steve Feldman is managing editor for Biblical Archaeology Review, published in Washington, D.C. Steve, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
You're welcome.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The pressure to compromise your ethics in business can come from almost every direction. Your employer, your employees, or your customers. God never promises financial success to the ethical businessman, but do good ethics make for good business? In our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, you'll find out why ethical compromise isn't necessary in business. Order your copy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling, or order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that permanently eliminates the death tax. Last year, Congress agreed to phase it out by 2010, but in 2011, it will be back. This legislation kills it for good. David Brody reports from Washington.
This is a cruel tax that punishes people for working hard and saving enough to pass something on to their children.
Congressman Joe Wilson is no fan of the death tax. Americans that own $675,000 or more when they die lose 40% of the money to taxes. But liberal Democrats like Congresswoman Louise Slaughter defend the government grab.
Now, what does this say to the American people when we prioritize the checkbooks of the wealthiest 2% of Americans before paying for health care for our veterans and fully funding education?
Congressman Jim Ryan says the huge tax burden puts farming families in a tough spot.
Sadly, the family had to part with the farm in part due to the death tax. Examples such as this have become far too common in my district and across this great nation.
Republicans say it makes sense that once you get rid of a tax, it should never come back. Otherwise, you're playing games. Chris Edwards with the Cato Institute says there's no reason why Uncle Sam needs to give you one last parting shot on your deathbed.
This income is already taxed. When people first earn money, it's taxed, of course. So then they save and they invest in a business and they earn profits. It's taxed again.
The House passed this same bill in the last Congress, but the Senate didn't act on it. And even though Republicans control the Senate now, there's no guarantee that the votes are there for passage. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The final vote was 264 to 163. Recent polls show that 89% of Americans believe the government should not tax a person's earnings after they die. The death tax accounts for only about 2% of the government's revenue. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Are you out of work and out of school? Do you want to earn your GED, get paid training in construction and an education stipend, build affordable housing, help your community, and get a good job after you finish the program? If you're 18 to 24 years old, a St. Louis City resident, drug-free, and don't have a high school diploma or GED, check out Youth Build St. Louis. For more information, visit youthbuildstl.org.
In today's fast-paced business world, where compromise is easy, where can we turn for practical and moral guidance? Find out with the book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Christian Ethics in the Workplace is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Jim Truesdell. He's co-author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, titled Christian Ethics in the Workplace. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later in the conversation. He's president of Brower Supply Company in St. Louis, and he is affiliated with the St. Louis University Emerson Center for Business Ethics. Jim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. It's great to be back.
Jim, I want to walk through, you know, we've been approaching this Christian Ethics in the Workplace subject from just about every angle that we can, and I want to go through some practical, real-life scenarios that do occur in the workplace and in the business world and have you speak to them as a businessman and as someone who's also interested in Christian ethics in the workplace. Let's start right in with one that probably is a biggie. I mean, if someone ran into this in the business world, they'd consider this a big one. Their superior at work, their boss, is doing something illegal. He's doing something unethical. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, I'm going to pull this from the chapter that you have written in the book on dealing with this, that my boss asks me to falsify a record of a date for a purchase order so that a factory warranty will apply to a favored customer. In other words, the warranty is going to run out. I want to make this warranty extend for this customer. Can we fudge on the date for this favored customer? You know, he's a customer, and the customer is always right. How do I respond to this situation?
Well, first, I think the customer is always entitled to respect and our best efforts. But I think sometimes when we say the customer is always right, sometimes the customer asks us to do things that are not right. And we don't want to find ourselves getting drawn into something there. We want to look for alternative ways that we can please our customer without drawing ourselves and that customer over the ethical line. And here, you've got the double sword here. You've got your boss giving you an order to do something, something that's going to go against your conscience. I think when we are confronted with these situations, first, we need to make sure that we're not just substituting our own judgment, because sometimes we can form ideas based on just a snippet of information. We don't really have all the facts, and we can think somebody's doing something that's ethically improper, and maybe they're not. So you want to go through a bit of a series of questioning about the situation. Consider, is it really wrong to carry out this order, or am I imposing my own self-righteousness on this situation? Maybe I don't have all the facts. Then you ask yourself, will anyone be harmed if I carry out this order? Will the systems or the procedures that are designed to protect against ethical lapses in this company be compromised if I follow the order? What if I go to my boss and ask him for a signed written directive to do this? Okay, I want you to initial that you're going to do this. Is that going to cause my boss to think about it? But what if he does? Am I still going to do something that I feel is wrong just because I've got his initials on it telling me to do that? Maybe that's not all the permission I need. It really gets down to how we're going to be able to live with ourselves. Will we look back and regret not refusing to carry out this order? Finally, what would Jesus want me to do? You know, earlier in the book, we cite a test that my co-author Ray Hilgert sets forth, the inner voice test. If that little voice tells you that something you're about to do is wrong, it probably is. And it's that voice of conscience that we need to develop throughout our lives by going into the Word, by going to the Lord in prayer, by associating with good, ethical, and moral people, so that that little voice will speak to us and tell us when we're stepping over the line. There's a price to be paid sometimes in alienating a customer, getting your boss upset, but there's a bigger price to be paid if we compromise ourselves and we step over the line. So I think you need to go through this analysis when you're confronted with this situation.
Here's another scenario. This is from the employer's perspective, to kind of turn it around a little bit, and that has to do with how much we pay someone. Often the employer is aware that he has an employee who really has no other recourse. He doesn't have another job lined up someplace else. He's got family commitments. He's got the mortgage to pay. He's got kids in college. And I really have him kind of right where I wanted him if I wanted to do this. In order to simply maximize the profits of the company, I could keep him or put him in a wage situation where I was paying him less than he's worth. But it would mean that the bottom line would accrue to the company a little better, and I'd get some credit for saving the company some money. When does this become exploitation?
Well, first, from a practical and a worldly situation, the company might benefit in the short term if you exploit an employee in such a fashion. But these companies are found out in the long run. They don't build a loyal employee base, and the long-term benefits of the company is not to exploit the workers. But again, we cannot just look at it for what's in the worldly interest of the company, in the worldly interest of the business. I think we need to go a little deeper. And when we're in that position of power of the employer, we need to, again, go through an analysis, asking ourselves, is there any semblance of equal bargaining power here? If that employee, that prospective employee, has no other options but to take this job, then the employer certainly needs to go beyond the employer's own self-interest to be truly fair. And being fair, it doesn't mean you pay more than the job is worth, but you do try to keep your wages in line with what's being paid for similar jobs in the area for people with similar skills. In particular, a lot of jobs, too, depend upon fair and full disclosure. Sales jobs that are involved on commissions and bonuses. When you hire somebody in this situation, you need to tell them what is the potential of this territory. What's the history? What's going on here? Lots of people have been in situations where they've been sucked unfairly into a job because a rosy picture has been painted of a potential that just isn't there. And that just comes down to full disclosure when you're setting wages for somebody. But again, it comes down to the way that we look at our employee, how we value that person as a human being. Do we look at them as just a tool or an asset to be utilized, or do we recognize them as a fellow human being? Do we really view them as a partner in our enterprise, or are we treating it more like a master-slave relationship? Comes down to the golden rule. You want to treat other people in the same way that you want to be treated, and that's what our God calls upon us to do when we're in that power position of an employer.
Here's a scenario, Jim, that comes not from the employer's or from the employee's perspective, but perhaps from the customer's perspective, where the pressure is put on the business, someone working in the business, from the customer. The customer says, look, I can make it worth your while if you will give me, in fact, I'll make it personally worth your while. Here's a little extra money or ball tickets or something like that. If you can give me a little consideration, and you're being asked or pressured by a customer through a kickback or a bribe or some other consideration, as they call it, to compromise your ethics as a business person. How should we begin to think about this scenario?
Well, we can look at it as an opportunity to witness for our faith, and it requires us to use all the tact that we possess and to speak gently, but we can help move that customer away from the course he or she is pursuing. Seek alternatives that can help that customer, but don't take you across that moral line. Say, well, you know, we really can't do that, but let's look at how we could help you cut your costs by maybe keeping those items in stock for you, or we'll have them delivered to you when you need them on every Monday morning, if that's what it is. In other words, come back with acceptable alternatives that can turn the customer away from whatever he or she is trying to get you to do. Then suppose what that customer is asking you to do does step over the line of legality. Well, maybe that customer needs to tactfully have the legal risk pointed out to them. Maybe your customer doesn't have a moral code, but he or she will understand the threat of fines or jail. But being tactful, you can allow the customer that out that, oh, you know, you're probably unaware, but, you know, that's not a legal way of going at things. Most people don't want to be perceived as crooks, so you let them back off and save face. You certainly can't go around preaching to your customers, or you won't have a business if you treat them that way. But you do stand your ground, and if you do, there's a good chance you'll gain that customer's respect with a tactful refusal to participate, and you may still get the business. You might even cause that customer to rethink his or her behavior. You never really know.
Now, that's interesting, and I'm glad that you put the emphasis there on the tact, because it really is called for in business that if you simply came out and said, what you're asking me to do is unethical and I flatly refuse, you might not only lose the customer, lose the opportunity to make any kind of connection for as a Christian witness to the person. But
right.
If you give them the alternative and say, what you're asking me to do, you may not be aware of this, but what you're asking me to do is illegal.
Right. Let them save face. He or she may have been testing you. Let's see if I can get this guy to step over the line and do something illegal, immoral, that will benefit me. And he may be testing you, but you let that person save face. You know, maybe you didn't understand, but that could get us in a lot of difficulty if we did that. Let's look at some other ways maybe we can accomplish this. Tact is certainly the key to also being a good witness, as we let people know we're not going to step over that line, but we don't put them on the defensive, and we lead them, hopefully, in the right direction also.
We're talking with Jim Truesdell. He's one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month. I'll tell you about that in just a minute. Jim is president of Brower Supply Company here in St. Louis. He's also affiliated with the Emerson Center for Business Ethics at St. Louis University. We're talking about meeting the ethical tests of the workplace, and they are very many. There's no doubt about that. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June is called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. You can purchase the book online tonight by going to our Issues Etc. website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section there, you're going to find information on Christian ethics in the workplace, issuesetc.org, or
You can order the book from Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours. Their number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also buy this book at one of the Concordia Publishing House bookstores, either the one here in Clayton on the campus of Concordia Seminary, or in St. Louis at 3558 South Jefferson Avenue. When you buy the book, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. The address again for either of those bookstores for Concordia Publishing House, one is located here on the campus of Concordia Seminary, 801 DeMunn in Clayton, or on South Jefferson Avenue at 3558 South Jefferson Avenue. Jim, here's another one, and this may be so deeply ingrained into the fabric of a business that it's almost impossible to sort this one out. When coworkers, employees have gotten into the habit of stealing, either by way of embezzling funds or by way of simply misusing the resources of a company, but stealing from the company itself. And I understand a lot of companies, because they lose so much to their employees by way of theft every year, even build this into their budgets, kind of adding a little justification for employees to say, look, the business has built this into their budget. They expect us to steal. They expect us to take home the typewriter ribbon in the old days, or the copy machine cartridges in our modern day, or the computer software in the 21st century. How do we deal with a situation where it is deeply ingrained in the fabric of the business?
Unfortunately, there are too many companies where that has become part of the culture. And people can say, well, you know, what can I do? Everybody around me is doing it, and this is the way it's accepted. It becomes accepted because everybody does it, and everybody joins in. And somebody and some groups of people along the way have got to start to change that thing. The culture of a business is often set by the people at the top, but it can be affected and it can be changed by people at all levels of the business. And it involves somebody first refusing to participate and subtly and tactfully saying, no, I just don't think I'm going to get, you know, that's not right. But we also need to remember that we are stewards of the assets of the business, and we have an obligation to our employer as part of the implied contract when we take our job to protect those assets. So first thing, we don't join in that culture and participate. Two, I think here's again where we need to use our tact to approach our friends and coworkers and say, you know, that's wrong, and I don't think that's the way we really want to do things around here. If this is a serious situation, I think you need to directly confront them. You need to stop this and return this material. And if you don't, I'm going to have to bring this to the attention of management and then follow through. That is our duty as stewards of the business assets. I do think that we first directly approach the offending people and let them know what we think about it, and give them that opportunity to mend their ways and make the restitution. Again, most people don't want to be perceived as crooks, as I said, and they don't want their fellow workers to perceive them as such. So give those people that opportunity to change. But most of all, don't become part of that culture yourself.
Is it a good idea, if I'm going to take a job, at the very outset, to ask when we're going through the process of, you know, becoming an employee, if I discover some wrongdoing, how do I go about reporting that? What is the policy of this business if there is unethical practices here? Even before you become an employee, to find out if the business has any kind of policy in place for dealing with unethical behavior.
I think by asking such a question when you're in that interviewing stage, you can find out a lot about that company and whether they are concerned with right or wrong in helping you make the judgment if this is the company you want to be associated with. Now, I know in the employment market, sometimes we take the job that's available. But it will tell us a little something about the company, and I believe that it will also tell that prospective employer a little bit about you and what you stand for, that you are concerned with being that steward of the assets and letting them know that you're not going to be part of any culture if it exists at that company. And if that company and the people that are interviewing are ready to respond, with a clear statement of what they perceive is right and wrong instead of a muddled ambiguity, then you probably know you're dealing with a company that does have a moral code that they expect their people to follow.
There are certain businesses that are, it seems, almost built into the way the businesses are done, that there's a lot of shady dealings. I won't mention what these businesses are, but everybody has in their mind a handful of kind of trades where it seems like everybody who works in this trade is kind of shady. They take materials from one job and shift it to another, and money gets shifted here and there, and everybody's a little fast and loose with the truth. And someone says, you've heard it before, I could never work in blank, that business, that industry, because just being a part of it requires dishonest dealings on a daily basis. Do you share that kind of dark view of certain industries that are just inherently shady?
Well, there are industries that are certainly based on wheeling and dealing. And you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with wheeling and dealing. That's part of our capitalist system. However, there are subgroups of industries. There are certain situations where people make a point of dealing with misrepresentations, exploitation. Normally, these are situations where the sales are not repetitive sales to customers. Because if you're in a situation where you're dealing with a regular customer that's buying supplies or something on a consistent basis, he or she is going to find out about you and your company and not keep that repetitive business up. But a lot of times where you've got situations where people are pushing one sale here to a person and they're not going to see that customer again, there's a temptation to let's get the money at any expense. If we are in these businesses, we have the opportunity to let our light shine and to be something different. I don't think we should shy away from an industry just because we hear there are problems in this industry. If we do that, that's never going to change. If good people turn away from an industry, that industry's ills will never be resolved. We can go in and maybe make a difference and be the person that stands against the tide. And that in itself can be a feeling of accomplishment, a feeling of reward that that we can take throughout our lives.
Up to this point in the conversation, Jim, we've talked mostly about ethical dilemmas that involve dollars and cents, money changing hands, or good and services changing hands. There's also another one that is less tangible, and that is the scenario of just kind of dirty office politics, where someone isn't necessarily stealing from the company, but they might be taking credit for someone else's work, or they might be taking opportunity with the employer to badmouth their fellow employees for the purposes of getting in the good graces of the employer, telling on other employees, making other employees look bad, when in fact, you know, without giving the other employees a chance to respond. How do we deal with this?
Well, yes, we've talked about financial scenarios, but when it comes down to pure human anguish and people that have a lump in their throat going to work every day, it's sometimes these situations where people get involved with this jockeying for position, figuratively stabbing people in the back. And again, we have an obligation, one, not to be a part of that, not to work for our advantage by getting involved in these kind of activities, but to stand up and make a statement. We're not going to do that. When you look at Scripture, back in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul was speaking to the church at Corinth, and he talked about that there was quarreling, jealousy, and outbursts of anger, factions and slander, gossip, arrogance, and disorder, and he called on them to stop that. Well, just as the church had that problem, our workplaces had that problem, and clearly Scripture calls on us to put an end to it. And in so doing, you know, we can make our workplaces a lot more pleasant and more productive places for people to spend this good part of their lives that they do spend every day of the working week.
A final scenario has to do with something that is really the mother's milk of capitalism, and that is debt, borrowing for capital purposes, and collecting debt. Where do we draw the line here? I mean, someone looks at, say, the credit card company, and they say 21% interest. If a person really needs to use that credit card when they're desperate, That's usury. That's extortion. That's taking advantage of people. And yet there are people who, in good conscience, pick up the credit card and are more than willing to pay whatever interest rate is necessary for the convenience of using someone else's money. And they pay them off, and they find no problem there. How do we sort out the whole issue of debt,
lending and collecting upon debts without falling into an ethical dilemma? Well, we've got about 2 minutes.
Certainly, here. If we partake of credit services, if we borrow money, we have an ethical obligation to pay it back. That means we don't, if we're in business, use somebody else's money, borrowing with the intent that we're not going to pay it back, or that we're going to hold on to someone's money for 90, 120, 150 days and use that. On the other hand, if we are the lender, we certainly need to refrain from abusive collection tactics, from backing a person into a corner, from excessive interest rates. But, of course, there are legitimate administrative costs a lot of these credit card companies have. And if their profits are not excessive and their interest rates reflect the true cost of doing business for that convenience, that's part of the bargain you enter into when you get into there. It goes to the way these things are administered. Are we doing it in an exploitive way, in an abusive way? And each one of us needs to be careful the way we use our own credit so that we do not put ourselves in a position where we bring that exploitation upon ourselves.
Jim Truesdell, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd.
Jim Truesdell is president of Brower Supply Company, based here in St. Louis. He's also affiliated with the Emerson Center for Business Ethics at St. Louis University, and he is co-author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Order this book online tonight by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. There's a section there titled What's New. You'll find information on Christian Ethics in the Workplace right there, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. You can also buy the book, if you want to, at one of Concordia Publishing House's two locations for their bookstores. The first is found here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, 801 DeMunn Avenue, if you're interested, or at South Jefferson, 3558 South Jefferson. Both of those stores carry the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. When you write or when you order online or when you go to the bookstore, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the last hour with two guests talking with Dr. James Hitchcock for the first 25 minutes about next week's meetings of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, about the resignation of former Governor Keating from the Oversight Committee for the U.S. Bishops on the issue of priestly abuse. That was a big story. We have unfolding news on that. And I'd also like to talk to him about that Phoenix bishop who very recently had his authority stripped by the state and has just been arrested for leaving the scene of a fatal accident. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.